part, that social distancing. I'm Nikki Strong, praying and hoping that you stay safe during this pandemic. VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Public health officials across the United States are preparing for the biggest vaccination effort in U.S. history. That is because they are likely to approve within weeks a vaccine against the new coronavirus, which causes COVID-19. As a result, they will need to give out hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine and decide who gets the vaccine first. The effort will involve making sure people who get the first vaccine shot return for the second one, which is required. Drug maker Pfizer recently raised hopes by saying early trials suggest its vaccine is 90% effective. The biotechnology company Moderna reported success Monday with a second vaccine in a major study. The company said the vaccine appears to be 95% effective based on early data. The push could begin as early as next month, when federal officials say the first vaccine may be approved for emergency use. Federal officials have stated that once that happens, they will immediately provide doses to high-risk groups, such as healthcare workers. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the top infectious disease expert in the U.S. He said last week that he hopes all Americans will be able to get shots in April, May, and June. In Philadelphia, the health department is counting how many healthcare workers and others would be among the first to receive the vaccine. In Louisiana, officials are planning an online exercise to test different situations and see how the process might work. If you get 10,000 doses, what are you going to do? What about 100,000 doses? Those are questions Dr. Frank Welch thinks about. He is director of Louisiana's immunization program. Similar preparations are happening at the federal level by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For the vaccination effort to get started, state officials have been readying systems to track supplies. They also will carefully record who has been vaccinated. That information will be placed into a national network. Vaccine providers such as pharmacies and doctor's offices will also need to be able to use the records. That way, people do not have to return to the same place for their second shot. More than one vaccine could also become available, and doses cannot be mixed. We not only have to bring people back for a second dose, but need to make sure that we have very good records of which vaccine they received the first time, said Dr. Jinlin Chan of Maryland's Health Department. States already have immunization registries, which will be used for for COVID-19. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, wanted providers to report the race and ethnic group of the people they vaccinate. The goal is to better understand whether high-risk groups are getting vaccinated. But pharmacies and other providers objected.
We have to be careful not to give providers too many duties, Mitchell Rothholz told the Associated Press. He is with the American Pharmacists Association, an industry group. He said providers have been told they will have the choice to leave that information out. Providers will also have to report vaccination information every day. This will be a change for those that usually enter it weekly or less often, state officials said. To help people find doses in their area, the CDC wants to put information on a website. The site will be updated each day. Supplying information on how many doses are available might be difficult for some providers. That includes a hospital in Utah that said it only has one person who currently enters the information, said John Reed. Reed supervises the state's immunization registry. States are also working to expand the number of pharmacies, doctor's offices, and other providers that can give COVID-19 vaccine shots. But registration can take time, Reed said. That is because providers often need help filling out documents. They also need help getting technical systems working and going through inspections to ensure they can meet storage requirements. For example, the Pfizer vaccine needs to be kept at a temperature of minus 70 degrees Celsius. Reed does not expect smaller pharmacies to become COVID-19 vaccinators for this reason. Moderna's vaccine, however, does not need extreme cold storage. This makes it easier to transport. Moderna says the vaccine can be kept at temperatures of 2 to 8 degrees Celsius for 30 days. And it can be stored for up to 6 months at minus 20 degrees Celsius. Both vaccines require people to receive 2 shots, several weeks apart. So the CDC is considering ways to help Americans remember the second shot. Getting the vaccine to people is another problem. The Pfizer vaccine, for example, comes in shipments of nearly 1,000 doses. That requirement makes it difficult to get smaller places vaccinated, said Rich Lakin. He is director of Utah's immunization program. Healthcare workers may have to drive to a hospital to get the vaccine doses, Lakin said. In North Dakota, providers receiving fewer than 1,000 doses will have them shipped to a state storage center that can keep the vaccine extremely cold. We will divide them into the smaller amounts and then drive them to the provider, said Molly Howell. She is the state's immunization director. But even if things go smoothly, officials worry people will not want the shots. Patrick Peer operates the Good Neighbor Community Health Center in Columbus, Nebraska. If there's going to be any real challenge, to be honest with you, it's going to be convincing folks to get the vaccine, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
When the new coronavirus began appearing in the news in January, Sarah Keeley was working as a medical document copier. She had completed her university studies in biology and was considering her future career. By February, as the disease spread across the United States, Keeley made her decision. She would work in the field of public health. "This is something that's going to be necessary," Keeley remembers thinking. "This is something I can do. This is something I'm interested in." In August, Keeley entered the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to become an epidemiologist, someone who studies how disease spreads and can be controlled. Public health programs in the United States have seen a sharp rise in enrollment during the continuing health crisis. As state and local public health departments struggle with reduced budgets, increasing demand, and even threats to workers' safety, a new generation is entering the field.
The Association of Schools and Programs of Public Health reports a 20% increase in applications to Master's in Public Health programs for the current school year. Some programs are seeing even bigger jumps. Applications to Brown University's Master's in Public Health program rose 75%, says Annie Yelsvik. She is a professor and director of the program. "Demand was so high as the pandemic hit in the spring that Brown extended its application process by over a month. 70 students joined the program this autumn, compared to 41 last year. People interested in public health are interested in solving complex problems," Yelsvik said. "The COVID pandemic is a complex issue that's in the forefront every day." Magnolia E. Hernandez is an assistant dean at Florida International University's Robert Stempel College of Public Health and Social Work. She said new student enrollments in its Master's in Public Health program grew 63% from last year. "The school has especially seen a rise in interest among Black students, from 21% of newly admitted students last fall to 26.8% this year."
Kelsey Campbell is one of them. She is part Jamaican and part British. When she heard in both the British and American media that the Black community and ethnic minorities were being especially hurt by the pandemic, she wanted to learn why. The biochemistry major at Florida International said she plans to explore that question when she begins her public health program at Stempel College in Florida in the spring. She said she hopes to one day put her public health degree to work by helping her own community. "There's a power in having people from your community in high places, somebody to fight for you, somebody to be your voice," she said. Public health students are already working on the front lines of the nation's pandemic fight in many places. Students at Brown's public health program, for example, are examining infection data and looking at the spread of the disease for the Rhode Island Department of Health.
Some students who had planned to work on international public health issues changed their goals as they watched the effects of COVID-19 in their own communities. Emily Saxvig, a public health and engineering major, had planned to start working this year as a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya. The 23-year-old had dreams of working overseas on international public health. The pandemic forced her to cancel those plans. She decided to begin her master's studies in public health at Emory University in the state of Georgia. The pandemic has made it so that it is apparent that the United States needs a lot of help too, she said. It changed the direction of where I wanted to go. Students like Saxvig are entering a field that faced serious problems even before the pandemic. A study by the Associated Press and Kaiser Health News found that since 2010, spending per person for state public health departments has dropped by 16% and for local health departments by 18%. At least 38,000 state and local public health jobs have disappeared since the 2008 economic recession.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's Civil War in the 1860s did not have the full support of the people. Many said they did not care who won, North or South. They just wanted to be left alone. In the North, many young men refused to be drafted into the Union Army. Some of their protests turned violent. Southern leaders were pleased with the anti-war movement in the North. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory. Lee hoped for a final, decisive blow that would bring the war to an end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about General Lee's campaign north to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Gettysburg was a small town. Many roads came together there. Robert E. Lee needed those roads to pull his army together quickly. He had 70,000 men in all, but they were spread over a wide area of southern Pennsylvania. Some were at York to the east. Some were at Carlisle to the north, and most were at Chambersburg to the west. All of them were ordered to move against the Union force at Gettysburg. General Robert E. Lee had not planned to go to Gettysburg. He had planned to capture Harrisburg, the state capital, and then Philadelphia. If successful, he would turn south to seize Baltimore and Washington. Lee had not worried about the large Union Army of the Potomac. He believed it was far behind him in Virginia. But Lee was wrong. The Union Army had followed him, and it had reached Gettysburg first.
The first group of Northern soldiers formed a thin line of defense outside Gettysburg. The first group of Southern soldiers attacked this line. It was the morning of July 1st, 1863. When the guns began to roar, both sides hurried more men to the front. After hours of fighting, the Confederates had pushed the Union soldiers back through the town. The Union soldiers formed a new line along a place called Cemetery Hill. General Robert E. Lee decided not to attack the hill immediately. He would wait for more men. But as he waited, more and more Union soldiers arrived. By sunrise the next day, Lee's 70,000 men faced a Union army of 90,000 men.
The Confederates attacked both sides of the Union line. They moved the Union soldiers a little, but then the Union soldiers came back again. The Confederates could not hold the line. The fighting stopped at sunset. Union Commander George Meade met with his generals. He said he was sure General Lee would attack again the next day. The next attack, Meade said, would be against the center of the Union line. Meade was right. Lee planned to send 15,000 men against the Union center. They would be under the command of General George Pickett.
When the sun rose on July 3rd, the Union troops were ready. They watched as the Confederate troops set up their cannon. More than 130 of these big guns were aimed at the center of the Union line. The morning passed. The day grew hotter. A little past 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a Confederate gun fired once. Then again. That was the signal to attack. All at once, the Confederate artillery thundered with a deafening roar. The cannon sent iron and smoke into the Union soldiers on Cemetery Hill. Within minutes, hundreds lay dead or dying. Union artillery on the hill answered the Confederate cannon. Men lay flat on the ground. They prayed for the shelling to stop. Finally, it did, and the smoke of battle began to clear.
Now the Union soldiers could see across the valley. They watched as the Confederate soldiers formed a long line. It was a sight to take your breath away. Facing Cemetery Hill, the Confederates stood shoulder to shoulder in a line almost 2 kilometers long. Sunlight shone from their guns. Their battle flags waved. Slowly, the line began to move. It seemed more like a parade than an attack. Shouts went up and down the Union line. Here they come. Here come the rebels.
Thousands of Confederate soldiers moved across the valley outside Gettysburg. Union artillery opened fire. The guns tore open big holes in the Confederate battle line. But the Southerners kept moving forward up the hill. Union soldiers rose up from behind stone walls and fallen trees. They poured even more gunfire into the Confederate line. More and more bodies fell to the ground.
Still, the line moved forward. A few Confederates reached the Union line, but not enough to seize it. They were shot down. Suddenly, the Confederates began racing down the hill. Many raised their hands in surrender. 15,000 began the attack. Only half returned. The Battle of Gettysburg was over. The Union commander, General Meade, was told that the Confederate attack had been broken. He said simply, "Thank God." The Confederate commander, General Lee, said, "This has been a sad day for us. A sad day."
Lee's invasion of the North had failed. There was only one thing he could do now: retreat. He must get his army back to Virginia. He could only hope that the Union army was hurt too badly to chase him. The line of wagons carrying wounded soldiers was 25 kilometers long. Many of the wounded needed treatment, but the wagons were not permitted to stop for any reason. Suffering was terrible. An officer who led the wagon train said he learned more about the horrors of war on that one trip than he had learned in all of his battles. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed, wounded, or listed as missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. 23,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing.
General Meade lost so many men that he was in no hurry to chase General Lee. He believed it might be best to let Lee escape than to take a chance on losing what remained of the Army of the Potomac. Meade waited for a week until his army was stronger. But by then, Lee and his men had crossed safely back into Virginia. President Abraham Lincoln was angry. He had told General Meade that driving the Confederates out of the North was not enough. The Southern Army must be destroyed. "We had them," Lincoln said. "We had only to stretch out our hands and take them. And nothing I could do or say could make the army move."
President Lincoln believed that General Meade had made a mistake, but he felt that the general had ability. Lincoln was thankful for what Meade had done at Gettysburg. He said Meade would continue to command the Army of the Potomac. In November of 1863, President Lincoln went to Gettysburg. He attended the opening of a new burial place for the Union soldiers who had died in the great battle there.
The governor of Pennsylvania had asked the president to say a few words at the ceremony. Lincoln agreed. He felt it was his duty to go, to honor the brave men who lost their lives to save the Union. Lincoln hoped his words might help lift the spirit of the nation. Lincoln did not have much time to prepare his speech. He wrote it down the night before the ceremony. Lincoln was sure the speech was not a good one, but it came to be one of the most famous speeches in American history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.